Good day and welcome to Storylines on the Bay 88.7 FM. I'm your host, Christine Cowley, and today we're speaking with local author David A. Franks about his book, 30 Days in Attawapiskat. David, welcome to Storylines.
Well, thank you, Christine, for having me on the show.
David, it's been almost 2 years since your first trip to Attawapiskat, and you've just returned from a second trip. Later in the interview, we're going to hear a bit more about that second trip, but let's just start with your initial reasons for wanting to make what turned out to be a very challenging journey on many levels.
My reasons for going were, first, I'd heard about Attawapiskat for almost 30 years, housing issues, sanitation, water problems, everything else, and I was wondering what our government was actually doing about it. Then Stephen Harper came out and made an apology for the residential school, the government's part in that project. And after that, we had the Truth and Reconciliation Commission put out a report, 94 recommendations. This was done between the Aboriginals and the Canadian government. And 2 years after that, we had a suicide emergency declared in Attawapiskat. And I was wondering, what's really going on up there? How come we can't seem to fix these problems? So I started looking into what issues the natives, what their solutions were to this problem. And I came across a poster put up at the community center by the youth there, and it said, "We want..." And there were a list, a youth center, a bowling alley, a movie theater. But somewhere down there, there was a community greenhouse. And it really resonated with me. I thought there were so many advantages to that. So I went up to see if it was possible.
You saw a project that actually you could personally have something to do with.
It was small enough for me to handle.
Yeah.
It was a one-off project. So I thought a community greenhouse was a great idea. It addresses the residential school issues in the nurturing, which was part of what was taken away when the children were taken from the parents. The parents didn't learn how to nurture, and the children didn't learn how to be nurtured or how to nurture their children.
Yes.
So this is part of it.
You learned once you got there that you needed to ask permission to be there from the chief, and that hadn't occurred to you.
Well, first, I was picked up by two native mental health care workers almost before I got out of the airport, and they took me to the same inn that they were staying at, and I was considered a mental health care worker because of that.
Mm.
It was a case of mistaken identity. Within a few minutes, they found out that I wasn't a mental health care worker and had just come up on my own, that nobody knew I was coming.
Mm.
And they said, "Well, you have to get permission from the chief." And it struck me then, I booked my flight out in 30 days, and I may be kicked off the reserve within 30 minutes. So I went and I told them, "Yes, I'm an author. I'm here to write the stories and share stories. I'm also a diabetes mentor trained by the Canadian Diabetes Association." So it was an opportunity for me to help in a small way that way as well.
Tell us the chief's reaction when he realized that you were just John Q. Citizen up there to see what you could do.
Well, I played my DNA native card. I am 5% native. I have Algonquin, Cree, and Inuit DNA. The chief liked that idea that I wasn't pure white. And he sat back in his chair and steepled his fingers and thought about this community greenhouse idea, which I proposed to him at the time. And he said, "You know, that's my idea. I wrote that down on that calendar."
Oh.
I was like, "Okay, interesting." And he said, "It's a good omen that you're up here." And I asked permission to raise money through the sale of the book, and he thought that was a wonderful idea. So that's where we started off.
You kind of found an inn with the chief, at least, for this 5% of Indigenous heritage. But somebody along the way called you a Native wannabe, and it really hurt.
Well, I found a great deal of racism on the reserve. And although I have Native DNA and I'm proud of it, I think it makes me more Canadian. I was offended that he would think I'm a wannabe. I have was not raised Native, and I have no intention of living like a Native. But I believe that they're part of the Canadian culture.
And there was more of that sort of cynicism that you ran into kind of again and again.
Well, I arrived in the middle of a suicide emergency. A young girl had killed herself. And what I don't think the rest of the Canadians realize is how tight the family units are up on the reserves. There's about 10 big families of 100 people each. And this affected everybody. They're all related. And it makes them a lot stronger, too. But when something like that happens, the community feels responsible for that.
Mm-hmm. And so that was one of the reasons why they felt you were somehow parachuting yourself into their midst without really belonging.
I don't think it was that. I think they were considered me a mental health care worker. Whether they understood that I was or wasn't, they wanted to unleash what was causing them grief.
Oh.
And so I was inundated with residential school stories, hatreds of whites, all kinds of different things.
And how did that make you feel?
It was shocking in the beginning, rather traumatic too, when you start getting all the detailed stories of tortures and rapes and starvations and everything else just because of their culture and their language.
Mm.
You know, I felt sympathy for it, but not guilt or responsibility for it.
Were you able to assert your purpose for being there?
My purpose was always to find out if a community greenhouse could be built there. And I discovered quickly that a glass and steel community greenhouse would not happen. Mm. The children like to smash glass up there. The windows all have wire mesh screens over them. The doors all have gated so that the kids can't break in. So car windows were smashed and they drive around with plywood in their windows for their cars. Elementary school teachers told me that I have to build a concrete bunker if I wanted to grow food. There's also polycarbonate I've discovered recently, which is almost indestructible. Mm. So it's a way to create the community greenhouse without it being destroyed by rocks or bricks or hammers.
So, you know, that brings us back to the people themselves are creating so much of their own, the destruction of their community. Tell us, what are your thoughts on that?
When I spoke with the police there, they said that the parents are really part of the problem, that they, not having learned how to nurture and having been confined and restricted to everything, they wanted to give their children the absolute freedom to be themselves. Well, kids are kids. They're going to get into trouble. And that's what's happening. There's actually a curfew at 8 o'clock at night. The children have to be indoors.
There was another thing the police had said that struck you and that you shared in the book, that their view of the suicide epidemic was, well, a bit shocking. They're saying kids are playing chicken here.
Yeah, the reports we got in the media down here was this outburst of attempted suicides, groups of kids talking about killing themselves and such. And it may very well have occurred, but the police believe that they go to these pill parties where they steal the drugs from their parents or grandparents and they pour them into a bowl and then take a handful and chew back these pills, and they have no idea what the repercussions of these pills are going to be. And some of the kids overdose, and they go into the hospital saying, I want to die. I'm overdosing. When the police arrive, they run. And it's a matter of the police chasing them, so now it's become fun.
So that is so not what we're hearing.
Exactly. It was just such a divide between what we're being told here and what the police set up there. Now, there's a lot of protection that goes on by the police and any of the elders, that they're trying to project an image that it's not as bad.
As we think, or as it's being reported?
As it's being reported in the South.
Do you think that's true?
I have no idea.
Having been there, you still don't know for sure.
I still don't know. They show you one face and it could be something completely different.
Mm.
The family is the biggest difference I found up there. They're very close.
Hmm.
And as I say, they're all related by blood.
So, David, in just a moment, we're going to take a short break to hear from our sponsors. And when we come back, I'm going to ask you to tell us about the return trip that you made last month, which didn't turn out quite the way you planned. But before we break, David, can you distill for us what maybe the most significant takeaways were from the first trip?
I'd have to say that there's no silver bullet solution to what's going on in Attawapiskat. There are so many different social issues going on. You can't solve them all at once.
Mm.
There's money problems. The government may give $200 million, and it sounds like, wow, that's a lot of money going to that reserve. But it doesn't go to that reserve. It goes to the Anishinaabe Nation of Grand Chiefs, which represents 51 reserves. Mm. And the money gets distilled down and spread out amongst those 51 reserves. The $220 million was also spread over 5 years.
When we come back in the second half, I'm going to ask you about the attitudes amongst some of the decision makers. Listeners, you're listening to Storylines on the Bay, 88.7 FM. I'm your host, Christine Cowley, and our guest today is local author David Franks. Please stay with us to hear more about his book, 30 Days in Attawapiskat, and what David saw, heard, and learned in Attawapiskat. Welcome back to Storylines on the Bay, 88.7 FM. I'm your host, Christine Cowley, and our guest today is author David Franks, whose book, 30 Days in Attawapiskat, followed his first trip to the Indigenous community. Attawapiskat in Northern Ontario is a community we've heard a lot about in recent years, mainly because of its suicide crisis among its young people. But David, you decided that the bits and pieces you were getting in the news or online weren't satisfying your need to know more about what was behind the challenges that Attawapiskat residents face. So you decided you were going to find out for yourself, you were going to get up there, and then it's not like you went up there with a big bag of cash. So there were challenges you met once you got there.
Well, it took me 4 years to save the money to go there. I could have gone to Jamaica and taken my wife to an all-inclusive for a month for the same cost. First, we had to drive to North Bay, then take a plane to Timmins. There are no connecting flights in Timmins right up to Attawapiskat, so I had to spend a night in Timmins. Then we flew out the next day in what I thought was a straight flight to Attawapiskat, but it turned out to be we stopped in Moosonee, Fort Albany, Keshechewan, all reserves along James Bay before we got to Attawapiskat. And once you pass Moosonee, they're all gravel runways, which was a new experience for me as well. It really is a rough ride when you land.
But once you got there, you discovered no cell phone. Groceries were almost unheard of. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, the first big shock was arriving at the Cataquapet Inn and being told it was $120 a night and it was a 10 by 10 room. And I was just shocked at the price. But anyway, I negotiated the price with the owner and we got it down to a reasonable rate by the end. But it also taught me that the native negotiation is not a yes and no. Hmm. It's a get to know the person you're dealing with first. Hmm. Talk to them about your dreams, talk to them about this and that and how their family and everything else, and then deciding what sort of deal you're going to work out together. And the culture of dreams and spirits was something completely different for me as well. And I'd had several polar bear dreams while I was up there, not realizing that there's a polar bear clan on the reserve. And I was welcomed into the dream circle. And my father taught me, when in Rome, do as the Romans. Mm. And it's something that I've used everywhere that I've traveled. And it works very well. Mm. Observe. Don't stand out too much and listen. And I realized that English is a second language up there as well. So you have to give people time to digest it and then come up with their answer. And it's switching languages back and forth. And you have to realize that whatever answer you're getting may not be exactly what they want to say.
So you've made a second trip. Now, were you looking forward to this, or was this an absolute necessity in order to complete what you'd started?
It was a part of the process of doing it. The first one was to meet the people and see if it was possible to do this at the cultural level. And yeah, I believe it's possible. There are people that grow food out on Potato Island in the middle of the Attawapiskat River. The first trip as well, the chief was in favor of it. He was on side with the project. This was inspiring to me. So I look forward to going up the second time. But an election had occurred for chief and council since my last trip up in 2016. So I had now to deal with a new chief and new council. So I wanted to meet with the chief, but there was no pressure this time to meet the chief because I was picked up at the airport by my friends and taken out for dinner and socialized quite a bit in the first couple of days there. So it was 3 or 4 days before I met with the chief. And it was not what I was expecting. I was hoping to get something in writing that in the new 10 square miles that was being added to the reserve by Prime Minister Trudeau, that they would put some land aside for the community greenhouse project, maybe 4 or 5 acres, because we want to build small greenhouses and teach how to build the greenhouses and maintain them. So we could build one each year.
Okay.
And train a crew that way. And then they can take this knowledge and go to other reserves. And it's not white men teaching, it's natives teaching natives, which is what they want.
How important is that? I mean, let's talk about that.
I think that's huge. They're tired of white men helping them. So far, they haven't done a bang up job. It's been 150 years of abuse and forced integration rather than helping them with their culture to advance it. And a real divide has occurred because of that. Most Aboriginal or First Nations people do not consider themselves Canadian. They're a nation within a nation, which was something I had not considered before.
Yes, you talk about that in the book. And tell us a little bit about your thoughts on that, like having heard that for the first time.
Well, the fact that they were asking me, have you read Treaty 9, which deals with Attawapiskat and a number of other reserves? And I'd never even heard of Treaty 9. I knew there were treaties out there between the Canadian government and the Native Nation, but I had never read one. And I didn't realize that the treaties had been just abused over the centuries. So there's a real hatred and lack of trust between the First Nations and the Canadian government. The First Nations now feel they have to stand up and fight for themselves.
So on your second trip, you were able to meet with the chief.
Yeah. Mm. He also told me that they couldn't, that housing was the biggest issue on the reserve right now, and that a greenhouse was not important to them and they would not allow it to be built on the reserve. I could build it out on Potato Island, which has no electricity and is only accessible 2 out of 4 seasons of the year.
Right.
So it was a challenge with no electricity. Now I have to start looking at alternative forms of energy. And okay, the design of the greenhouse we have lends itself to solar, passive solar, as well as solar panels. Have to watch solar panels because the kids up there like to break glass.
You were saying that this is the sort of thing that happens.
There's literally no parental guidance. There's no coaches for any of the sports teams. There's nothing for the children to do, for the young adults. There's no movie theaters up there. There's no recreational facilities whatsoever. The new elementary school that was built up there is state of the art. They have a theater with track lighting, its own sound booth, 3 basketball courts, a gym, everything else, but it's locked up at 4 o'clock with chains on the door.
Because so otherwise there'll be vandalism.
Possible. There's no one there to supervise. So you can't just let the kids go in and play.
Throughout your book, you remain a fairly objective reporter. Do you think you became more opinionated on anything as a result of your experience there?
Well, of course. You can't go anywhere like that without being changed. Did my opinions change? I still believe the greenhouse project can be accomplished, but it's going to take longer than I first anticipated. I was hoping to have the first greenhouse built by now.
Okay. So your expectations have had to change.
Absolutely. And I've come to realize that people who go up for a weekend or a week and try to make a big change and save the Aboriginal people, they walk away happy that they've done something, and the natives go right back to the way things were. So it's a time commitment that is needed. That if people are going to go up there and help, they need to stay for a few years. Not for a few days. And that's something that, well, I'm prepared to do for this first one. Because when we build the first greenhouse, they've never had one. So there has to be some sort of a course that teaches how to grow in a greenhouse.
Yeah, not you can't just build it and walk away.
No. So you may start with the elementary where kids start to germinate seeds in class and take it up when they get to high school into the what grow lights to use, what fertilizers to use, that sort of idea.
So this is a long-term project for you.
Of course.
Yes.
Of course.
Yeah.
That's the one thing I took away from this is it's nothing is going to be quick. It took 150 years to destroy the culture. It's going to take at least that long to fix it.
Do you believe you're making a difference?
I'll believe I've made a difference when I built the first greenhouse. Until then, I'm just getting the word out to the people down here because I don't think they know the reality of what's going on up there. Having traveled through Central America, I've seen third world conditions. And yeah, we have them in Canada to a scale I was not aware of.
Shocking, yeah.
When there's 650 reserves across the country and this is the basic state of them all that have stayed under the Canadian government's control. Mm-hmm. There are a few reserves that have declared autonomy, and they're flourishing. I believe there's one in Manitoba and the Quebec side of James Bay. The reserves over there have all declared autonomy and have now negotiated with the mining companies and are doing quite well.
Wow, that's really food for thought. David, it's been an education talking to you. Of course, your book was a terrific read. How can people learn more about what you're doing, David? Maybe there's someone out there who wants to help in some way.
Mm-hmm. On the 18th of March, I'll be at the Magnetowan First Nations Library out on Highway 529. That's at 1 o'clock till 3 o'clock. It's a Sunday.
Okay.
And the next day I'll be at the Chartwell Traditions Muskoka, or Muskoka Traditions, on 16 Legacy Lane here in Huntsville.
Great. Yep,
and that'll be at 2:30 till 3:30. Now, there's powwow drumming involved. There's a slideshow and video presentation and a question and answer period. So if anybody has any questions, these are two of the locations to come to.
Excellent. Is there a way that people can get in touch with you, David, if they can't make it to either of those?
Sure. I'm available on Facebook. They can use the messenger there. Get in touch with me that way. It's David A. Franks, F-R-A-N-K-S. And look forward to hearing from people.
And also, where can people buy your book?
Online at Amazon.com. And it's available at Kobo as well as an ebook edition and Kindle. I also teach memoir writing over at the Summit Center's Active Living. That's Monday evenings, 7 till 9. And you can register at the Summit Center. I have a writing group that I host out at the Dwight Library on the first Wednesday of every month from 10 till 12 in the mornings.
Great. So there's lots of opportunities for people to meet with you and learn more.
Absolutely.
David, it's really inspiring to see what you're doing and to hear you talk about it. Thanks again so much for being with us this morning.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me on, Christine.
Listeners, thank you for tuning in this morning to Storylines on the Bay 88.7 FM. Today we've been speaking with local author David Franks about his book 30 Days in Attawapiskat. I'm your host for Storylines, and we are here on Saturday mornings at 8 a.m., Wednesday nights at 11 p.m., and we will keep on talking to authors and book folks about books and the writing life. Thanks so much for tuning in. We hope you'll join us again.